Do you think that the modern island of Sri Lanka was not a part of the ancient Ramayana?
No, it would be part of ancient Ramayana. It wasn't Ravana's Lanka. East of Maldives, that's where Ravana's Lanka was. Right now, there is nothing, just a deep ocean.
So effectively, you are disagreeing with extreme right-wing portals, which highlight the Ram Setu as one of the most important.
Correct.
When we talk about megafauna, they say that all the animals that we see around us, only 1% of the animals that have ever existed.
Which is very true. And also, so the biggest extinction of them happened in 11,000 BC, beginning of a younger dryas.
Damn!
4 tusk elephants that are also described in Ramayana. You see, for example, that vertical line. This is basically 15 meters sudden sea level rise in the middle of 6 millennium BCE in the Arabian Sea. That's Krishna's Dwarka getting destroyed.
Where is this South America angle written about in the texts?
Indra is the deity of the east direction. Indra established it there. Ananta is referred to the Andes mountain with its sahasra heads as the each peak.
Oh, this is a real thing.
Yes. Okay, it's like almost 800 feet tall.
Damn! How deep have you gone in this stuff, sir?
Shurpanakha is actually been married, Ravana's sister, and has gone to South America.
It's lost knowledge.
They don't know who created. They don't know why it was created.
But it's described in the Puranas.
Ramayana.
When I used to see Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson's work, I always think there needs to be some Indian person who needs to go down and do the same kind of work, but from an India context. Honor of my life meeting you today. There's going to be many points during the course of this conversation where you'll be shocked. You'll be sitting back in your seat, wherever you are, whether you're watching this, whether you're listening to this, and you're going to go into a spiral of thought. And there's very few guests who can invoke that kind of reaction in both myself and the audiences. We found an all-star, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely loved speaking to Nilesh Oak. I've asked so many people these questions about the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Nobody in the history of TRS has been able to answer it with the kind of proof, with the kind of research, and with the kind of conviction that Nilesh Oak has answered these questions. We approached this historical conversation from a scientific and evidence-based bent of mind. You're going to enjoy it as much as I did. It's the first part of an epic two-part conversation. If you're someone who enjoys Indian culture, this is one of the ultimate conversations that have been uploaded on the Indian internet. I can promise you that. And I say that because of the content that will follow this intro. This is Nilesh Oak on TRS. Welcome to TRS, Nilesh Oak, sir.
Very happy to be here.
I love that you're an engineer. I love it even more that you're an evidence-based, I'd also say passion-based, modern-day historian in many ways. This is something I've learned from Dr. Luke Coutinho, who told me that like expertise is always an outcome of passion. And expertise becomes more of an expertise when you back it up with evidence and data. So we're doing a Mahabharata and Ramayana episode after a very long time on TRS. We've had archaeologists on the show. I've noticed that often academically trained archaeologists and historians really value evidence. And I'm sorry I'm starting it out like this, but they often dislike people like you. I don't think audiences dislike people like you. But it's always the professionals of an industry who've gone through that grind, who've put in those years of work in their own studies, who don't love it when someone without a degree actually comes and speaks. But if you scan history, there's been a lot of greats who've not gone to a particular college to study a particular subject and still become experts of that subject.
Yeah.
Let's begin by talking about dirt archaeology. I remember reading one of the Yuval Noah Harari books, I can't remember which one, where he spoke about the concept of fictions. So he said that when you go buy a car, which is created by Skoda, okay, what is Skoda really? It's a company. Who thought of the name Skoda? The guy who started it. Who thought of the logo? The guy who started it. Now, when you think of Skoda, you're thinking of a car company. But truly, what it is a fictional creation of the guy who started it. The same is the case for Beer Biceps, my channel's name. In 2014, I thought of the name and I thought of, you know, I'll make this YouTube channel. I'll call myself Beer Biceps. It's a fiction that came out of my head. Similarly, that's the case with history as well. Before history was taught in schools, some person in the past thought that we need to teach our kids about all these things that happened before they came into this world.
Mm-hmm.
What do we call this subject? Let's call it history.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, history grew in the story of mankind. And mankind reached a point where they realized we need to go deeper into history. Okay, so let's start a new field called archaeology. So archaeology also began as a fiction in someone's mind. And someone had to decide the rules of archaeology based on their experience in the field. Therefore, the rules of dirt archaeology were created. And dirt archaeology was created as a subject. Now, these same rules which began as a fiction in some Europeans' mind have made their way to archaeologists worldwide. And they are the flagpoles that these guys follow, which may be very good for their process. But I definitely feel that those flagpoles limit you to some degree at least.
Yeah.
And that's what I've picked up from people like yourself and Graham and Gok, that you guys think in open space, you guys think in free space, you all reference ancient texts. And y'all don't dismiss ancient texts based on the fact that they simply don't follow the rules of dirt archaeology. Now, apparently, when you ask an archaeologist in India about the truth about the Ramayana and Mahabharata, often they'll say that we don't have out and out evidence that it happened at this 5000-ish BC mark. What's the mark for Mahabharata?
For them, you mean?
No, what's the mark you've come
That's to? Like, so Mahabharata happened, I'll give you the formula of seven. Mahabharata happened more than 7,000 years ago. That's what the evidence shows. Ramayana happened more than 14,000 years ago. And Rigveda definitely more than 21,000 years ago. So think of the multiplication of seven.
I'm thinking of a very weird thing in my head, which I have to voice out. But based on the dates that you've given, which is 5561 BC, that's the Mahabharata. And Ramayana is?
12,209 BCE. Like, think simplicity, you can say more than 14,000 years ago for Ramayana.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So we are 7,000 years away roughly from the Mahabharata. And correct. The Mahabharata was 7,000 years away from the Ramayana according to your dates.
Yes.
So we are as far from the Mahabharata as the Mahabharata was from the Ramayana.
Yes.
Do you think that's why the knowledge is coming to the forefront again?
Because of the seven multiplication of seven? Yeah. Could be. I mean, I'm not a numerologist, yeah. But hey.
Mystical cycle thought. Of 7,000 years. Cute thought.
Good thought, yes.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you one more thing I've learned through the show, which is that when Krishna passed away at the end of the story of the whole epic, they say it was the beginning of the Kali Yuga. And the Mahabharata happened in the Dwapar Yuga. The Ramayana happened in the Treta Yuga. Now, again, if we go back to this timeline that I just mentioned,
yeah.
Effectively, does it mean that the time difference between each of the yugas is 7,000 years?
One may reach that conclusion. I would say I will give you a brief on the yuga, but that may require a full episode. That's how fascinating it is. Yuga, in the Indian context, the simple definition, if you look at the time, is a period of time. That's the simple definition. A certain period of time. Like, you know, it's like saying, bring me a cup of tea. But the cup size may change. Something like this. So yuga is a certain period of time. There is one researcher in Odisha. He's a retired IPS officer, Arun Upadhyayji. He has collected 26 plus different definitions of a yuga. To that, I have added 10 plus. So possibly the number sits at this. But to simplify the matter, I would say yuga is not even the period of time. Okay, there is a sense of it. I'll give you a quick, the Niles notes on that. Cliff's notes, okay? Four types. For example, in Aitareya Brahman, okay? This is based on your action. The yuga is defined. I will just, instead of Sanskrit, I'll just go English straight.
What is Aitareya Brahman?
Aitareya Brahman will go now, say, think of Vedas. The Veda has a Samhita, which is the mantra. After that, when the mantras are used in a yajna, there are some other manuals, like how to do the yajna. Okay. So car, you'd know how to drive a car, but how to maintain the car, how to start the car, check the car. So that is the Brahmana Grantha, nothing to do with the word Brahman otherwise or something like this. Then there is Aranyakas, which is a philosophical discussions on those mantras and the Yajna. And then there is Upanishad, which is essentially guru teaching that same philosophy and everything else to Shishya. So like that. So one of the Brahmana Grantha, Aitareya Brahman, connected to Rugved, it says when you are sleeping, you are in a Kali Yuga. When you wake up and sit up, then you are in a Dwapar. When you stand up, you are in a Treta. And when you get into action and you start walking, that is, you are in the Satya Yuga. Kritayuga. It says, Charayaveti, Charayaveti, Charayaveti. Keep on walking, keep on doing action. Stay in the Satya Yuga, stay in the Kritayuga. Now, this is nothing to do with the time. This has to do with the action. Okay? So let's look at another one, the emotional state. Like Einstein's, you would have heard, like, you know, you sit with a beautiful lady for an hour and it feels like a minute. And you sit on a hot plate for a minute and it feels like an hour. By the way, do you know that Einstein actually performed that experiment? Oh, that will be a digression, so I'll not go there. 1938, after doing this experiment, he wrote a paper. He borrowed Charlie Chaplin's wife for the date. And he traveled from New Jersey to New York in an oyster bar, sat there. And when he felt like, looked at the clock, 57 minutes. And he felt like with Charlie Chaplin's beautiful wife, he felt like it was only a minute. Then he went to New Jersey, performed the other experiment, sitting on a hot plate. Anyways, so exactly like this. In the Bengal, there was a great saint. You might have heard the name Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Like Hare Krishna movement sort of comes from that. He wrote only 8 shloka. One of the shloka he says, because he was a great Krishna Bhakta, Radha and Krishna Bhakta. He says, Yugayitam Nimeshena. So the word, Yugayitam Nimeshena, Chakshusha Pravrushayitam, Shunyaditam Jagat Sarvam, Govinda Virahenami. If I have a separation from Govinda, my Ishta Devata, Nimesha, just a blinking of an eye, that time feels like a yuga. So he's stating an emotional state, just like Einstein's theory there. This is the second kind. The third kind is what people have confused for the fourth kind. The third kind is like you have heard 432,000 years of Kali Yuga. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Double that is like a Dwapar, 864,000. Triple that is a Treta, and then four times that. That has absolutely nothing, nada, to do with the chronological yugas of Ramayana, Mahabharata, and so on. That has everything to do with a mathematical computation formulations in astronomy that allows us to tell us the absolutely precise and accurate orbital periods of planets. But somewhere that confusion happened, and it was used and understood to be the durations of yuga. And that's why you are comfortable when only 7,000 years. I'll come to that in answering that. The third one is basically there is a yuga of 5 years, okay, in the calendrical yuga, the Panchanga yuga. And then that was used along with the astronomy evidence of the type I refer to talk about the time periods. Okay, now to answer that question, so you said it seems like 7,000 years and the yuga is changing. Possibly so. But Mahabharata gives a beautiful definition. If you remember recently, our Prime Minister Modi ji, he referred to Kala Chakra Badal Raha Hai. If you have heard that statement in the context of Ayodhya Mandir and so, you know what it is. Actually, how do you change the Kala Chakra? We do it. And Mahabharata says, Raja Kalasya Karanam. A king or an administrator, depending on how he administers the kingdom, the particular type of yuga comes. And Rama, I will not belabor on that point, but Mahabharata goes on giving many examples of this. So depending on the administration, the time comes. And I add my original contribution, just like Raja Kalasya Karanam, I say Praja Kalasya Karanam. Praja has to develop the civic sense also, and a different type of yuga comes.
Okay. What would you like to say about that 7,000 year duration?
It's very magical. Okay, I find it very useful in the sense of mnemonics, but just the way I look at things, although it's a fascinating numerology thing, I don't read more into it.
Okay, fair. Let's talk a little bit more about the reality of the Mahabharata. The one thing I've always questioned even as a kid was, what were Rakshasas?
Hmm.
When you talk about Hidimba,
yeah.
Ghatotkach,
yeah.
Bakasur, effectively, if you truly try attaching it to reality was Bakasur some kind of a cannibal. Like just a really well-built cannibal. Was Hidimba and Hidim also something similar? And then if that's the case, why do we have a Hidimba temple in Himachal Pradesh?
Hmm.
Where they say that, oh, this is actually where she lived, near Khir Ganga, which is now known for stoners who go up to trek to Khir Ganga.
Right.
But there is a Hidimba temple there.
Yeah.
That's one question. Second question attached to that is, this is something very, very fascinating I learned from a Parsi priest who was on the show.
Hmm.
What he spoke about was that Zoroastrians are also an ancient culture. Yeah. And I've really deep dived into Zoroastrianism, which is the religion of the Parsis. I figured that it's perhaps definitely the sister religion of Sanatan Dharma. I'm pretty convinced.
I agree.
Even when you talk about the modern practices, it's literally in parallel with Sanatan Dharma. Be it worshipping fire, be it mantras, be it avastha, how we have Sanskrit. Now, in their mythology, the word daiva was villainous.
Yes.
In our mythology, the word asura was villainous.
Yeah.
Cuter fact, in their mythology, Ahura is noble.
Hmm.
Like it is the name of the angels.
Yeah.
And they pronounce sir as her. We have somras, they have homras.
Yes.
So their Ahura, is it our asura? And their daiva, is it our dev?
Correct.
Now, if again, if we try attaching these pieces of culture to reality, perhaps we were two warring tribes. And in our epics, the Asuras are painted sort of as villainous. But if you actually study the Vishnu Puran, if you actually study the Ramayana, there are some slightly heroic Asuras as well. So it's not like you're painting all of them as negative. You're painting most of them as negative with some exceptions. And I'm 100% sure that they would say the same about Daiva and Deva.
Yeah.
Also, they were based out of Central Asia. Iran, Uzbekistan, all these places. Now, was that what we count as Patal Lok in our culture?
There is a name for that land. Not Patal. Patal would be South America.
Okay. Interesting.
This one is a Uttara Kuru.
Okay.
And Uttara Kuru was known from this, we can talk about like a Ramayana times, because there is a reference to Kuru jungle in a Ramayana, which is like a Haryana area. But the Kurus were known, Uttara Kuru was known to Ramayana. So 14,000 years ago also Uttara Kuru existed, which is Iran. Think of northern Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, that area, east of the Caspian Sea. 2,000 years ago, the Greeks also refer to that land. Do you know how? Uttarakuru. Basically Uttarakuru. Okay. But that may take another episode, but let's come back to this. Actually, I studied just like what you said, what you studied, the Persian for a long time. My study started with Lokmanya Bal Gangadhar Tilak, who wrote a book, you know, the Orion and then the Arctic Home in the Vedas, going back to 140, 150 years. By the way, he is the Adya Archaea astronomer in the world, not just India. Astronomy, using astronomy in a way to understand our history in the modern times, was started by Lokmanya Bal Gangadhar Tilak. Okay. So the references that you said to, and I would ask you a question, did your guest, the Parsi guest, mention how far in the back in antiquity they refer to Zoroastrian religion?
Yeah.
Because I will say, if you want to say the number, that's great. If you remember how far back he wanted to go.
It went roughly to what you're talking about as the Ramayana time.
Great, great. Because in Mahabharata, there is an indirect reference to Narad Muni coming to Yudhishthir. And Narad Muni think of this as the journalist.
Hmm.
But journalist with the integrity. Okay. So there is a reference to Narad Muni coming to Yudhishthir and referring to a certain practice with the fire worship and all of this in a somewhat distant land, but not that far distant land. And as a very mysterious, interesting practice in about 7,000 years ago. Okay. But there are enough references. In fact, there is this reference to Atharva Veda. They are the followers of Atharva Veda. That is what is known. But something else. Asura, actually, if you look at into the Rugved, Asura is actually very much eulogized, you know, very much praised. It's not seen in the negative way at all. Indra is called Asura, which is the highest deity there, you know. So that's now, Varuna is called Asura. Over time, this is what happens. Why now we may say Rakshas as a bad person? Rakshas, the Sanskrit basis for this, there can be many meanings. That's the beauty of a Akshara. Shabda can have many meanings in the context, but Akshara, which is just a letter, can also have many meanings. When you combine, it becomes different meanings. Rakshasa is Rakshamiti Rakshasa, the one who protects. But think of it, one who protects means he has to be powerful or she has to be powerful with the weapon, knowledge and everything. Now, someone who is a powerful, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Over a period of time, something counter can happen. Simple example is our Sikh brothers. Not all of them, but Sikh, the origin of Sikh is into protecting Hinduism. But eventually, when the Khalistan movement came into being, they were talking things against India or against Hindus and so on and so forth. So those who were meant to protect Hindus at some point for a thousand different reasons, we'll not go into that, almost became enemy. That can happen. That's the reason of this. Now, so Ravana was a Rakshas. But Ravana is a, in the disciplic succession, he is a son or a grandson, great-grandson of a great sage, great rishi. But person can turn around, you know, that can happen. Back to the Hidimba and so on and so forth. Who are they? Basically, they are human beings. I mean, just to simplify things, I would say maybe they were people from Africa and they were having a connection. So somewhere looked at something, they were looked at as a different, slightly different things, different powers. I'm jokingly saying this, but actually there is a enough basis with a Ravana. Ravana, who has conquered the whole world, he had gone all the way to South America. I mean, in every direction. And he was, even India, he was controlling all the way to Himalayas and all the way to where we are sitting right now. That's why the, you know, his generals were there into Nasik, where from where actually eventually Shurpanakha incident happened and then Ravana snatched away Sita. So he was controlling the pockets. You know, in the old times, he was very powerful. So because of that, he has these relationships in the different parts of the world, you know, and then so intermarriages, so you can say inter-transnational marriages across the boundaries. So those, but they were human beings, very powerful human beings, very altruistic, very virtuous human beings.
My conjecture, and again, this is based on just hypothesis, perhaps slightly emotional hypothesis, because I love these epics, is that I think lifespans were longer then.
Lifespans were directionally longer, but not some. Sometimes you hear terms like, say, Ram, Bhagwan Ram, after he returned, ruled for 11,000 years. That is not to be taken literally. There is a statement that sometimes, you know, the formula helps you. In the engineering, you substitute something and, you know, kilocalories, calories like that. So there, the formula is Aho Ratra Samvatsara. The common sense should never be left out, you know. So Ahoratra Samvatsara, which means in certain circumstances, you consider a reference to a year equal to the day. And of course, vice versa.
Gotcha.
So 11,000 can be divided into days and that will come to 30 years or something like this.
Got it.
So not those extreme years. But to your point, absolutely valid. Based on the calculations in the Mahabharata, we have to accept, there is no other alternative to accept that Bhishmacharya was about 140 plus years old at the time of Mahabharata war and he fought for the first 10 days. That's almost impossible for us to believe. I don't mean folks out there. It's impossible for me to believe that.
Yeah.
But
in there is books like Autobiography of a Yogi, where they speak about detailed Kriya Yoga, which is a form of yoga that involves, for lack of better words, your own energy channels or prana or chi, like Chinese culture. Yes. They actually talk about how you can extend the biological life of your body. And there's multiple chapters on it, not going to deep dive into that for the sake of a free-flowing conversation.
Yes.
So I would assume that lifespans were longer.
Yes.
Health was generally better.
Yeah.
But the human outcome of a longer lifespan is a longer time to build bigger kingdoms. Because effectively, humans are tribal species.
Yes.
So effectively, what you're saying is they were probably just physically much better human beings.
Correct.
Who may or may not have had some kind of mystical powers, which is why they were initially perhaps kept for the protection of society. they had goodness in them as well.
Yeah.
But sometimes power could corrupt.
Correct.
That's why the heroes of the epics like Bhim, like Ramji come in and take on Rakshasas and Asuras. My question to you now is about the South America angle, because it's come up on the show.
Yeah.
Where is this South America angle written about in the texts?
Okay. No, great question. It's written in multiple places. But when we are narrating something, we have to start somewhere. So let's take that point as the time of King Bali. So in the Dashavatar series, the Vaman, you know, the Vaman Avatar. And Bali, Mahabali, or sometimes known as a Bali, was a very virtuous king, sort of in the southern part, you can say, you know, southern part of our modern day India. But it could be broad. He could have influence over Indonesia. We just don't know that. And he was so powerful, like Abhyuday. He has made such a prosperity that almost the other side is envious of it. Other side meaning within Indian context, I'm saying. And then they go to Vaman and says, do something about it. And I will not go into that story, but to bring it back to the Patal. So the story goes like this, and people should read it with all their previous spectacles removed, you know, like with a very objective fashion. They will get this. It's there in Bhagavad Puran. So he subdues King Bali. Vamana subdues King Bali. And we'll not again go to the detail because I want to take you to Patal. And then he is essentially kept in a house arrest. Okay, so he's given the freedom, but he's kept in a house arrest because he has such a great influence on his population. So they cannot be just gotten rid of, you know, so to say. And that house arrest, based on my understanding, was in Indonesia, where we call today the Bali, possibly.
Oof.
Now, Bhagavad Puran and many other Puranas go on to tell, and even some stray references come in Mahabharata and Ramayana also. So this incident is long before 14,000 years. The stray reference comes where after some time, the restrictions on Bali were removed. We have the description of that. But then Bali did not return. That's what it says. He went further to Patal. Now, if you just take a straight line and the navigation, you said speculated navigation. Actually, we don't have to speculate. The archaeology, the dirt archaeology, we have evidence of dirt archaeology of sophisticated ports in India, like say Tamil Nadu, Pumpuhar, going back to 20,000 plus years. So that was there. So now he went there. Now he went to Patal. That's all it says. And then he established various colonies, Sutala, Atala, Talatala, Rasatala, and many colonies like that. Now, if you take, now then the sort of a narration breaks down, because after that, there is not much description. The descriptions do come as how opulent and prosperous that land is. And now that after the Spaniards, it's very hard to believe that that is the case. But actually, if you look at their archaeological history and other history, it is I've been there many times.
You've been to South America?
Many, many times. I mean, I speak broken Spanish, you know, I mean, enough to get around myself alone, every country, multiple times. But you see, for example, Peru, they have 400, they not have now. In the ancient times, they developed 400 varieties of potatoes. And they know which potato to plant at which height and so on. If you look at the names, you will find some fascinating things. For example, so Bali did not return, went further to Patal. Now, this is the relationship. Bali's great-great-grandfather is not an immediate father, but it looks like as if he's a father, grandfather. No, not really. Many generations in between. He's a Virochana. Virochana, Prahlad, if those are the names. Now, in South America, there is a story that somebody came from across the land, across the ocean, to civilize us. And do you know what is the name of that person? Viracocha. Now, if you see the spelling, it can be Virochana, literally. Viracocha. And he civilized us. That is what the belief there is. So in the South America, the Incas, but you come further up to the Mexico and, you know, all that area. They have many stories like this. Another one, in Mexico, there are these people are called Aztecas. You know, I mean, Aztecas. Now, that has to do with Agastya, but also Aztec, the sages.
Oh, damn.
And think of the snakes. Like, you know, as a child, forgive me, as a child, when I grew up in Konkan, halfway between Mumbai and Goa, and we used to see lots of snakes. And, you know, our elders used to say, maybe to get rid of our fear, if you see a snake, just say, Astik, 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 three times and the snake will not do anything to you. Usually snake doesn't do anything to you. But that sage Astik is connected with the Nagas. Now Nagas, just like the Rakshasas, were human beings. They are mentioned in the Mahabharata very well. That's how the New Delhi, the Indraprastha was established, by getting rid of the Nagas, so to say, by burning the Khandava forest. So the sage who was connected with the Naga as a individuals, we have so many names Naga everywhere in the Andhra Pradesh if you go today, and Kerala, by the way. So those people also migrated there, possibly with a Bali. And that's why you see all the symbolisms of the, now Chinese call it dragon, because they took that route, by the way, you know, going there. And also the sea route, but also through Alaska. And so these Aztecas, the word is Aztecas. Again, they refer to that person as a someone who came and civilized them. But something more fascinating, Ramayana is aware of that land. Mahabharata is aware of it, but Mahabharata actually less so. But Ramayana, Sugriv knows so much about that land. I'll just give you an idea. Sugriva's Atlas is my talk series. So when all the Vanara parties, who are also human beings, by the way, jokingly I say the people of Karnataka, because that's where the Kishkinda capital was. So four parties, the Vanara parties, they are going in the four different directions. And Sugriva is giving them the landmarks, just like go there and take a left turn at a D-Mart, we will say in modern times in Mumbai. He says, go there, you will find this. So I'll just give you the east direction, take you to the Patal. Now he doesn't say Patal, he doesn't use the word Patal. But he says, okay, start there in the center of India. Then you will go to the land of silver, that is the Thailand area. Then the Yavadvip, so Ropyadvip, Yavadvip, that is the land of Yava, the grains, that is the Java. The Java has come from Yava. Then he keeps on describing many islands. Then he says, after that, you will see the ocean. That is possibly many oceans, but the Pacific. Once you cross this, now this is when it gets extremely fascinating. Once you cross it, you are going to come to the area of a Lord Ananta, Anantadev. And in that area, to mark the flag of Ananta, just like Arjuna has his own flag and Bhima has his own flag, that flag is inscribed into on the surface of the stone, surface of the mountain. And he describes how that mountain is. I'm going to say this to you. Trishira Kanchanas Ketu Talastasya Mahatmana Sthapita Parvatasyagre Virajati Savedika. I will split it. Trishira, like a trident. Trishira Kanchana, gold, shining like a gold, yellow color. Ketu, like a pillar, like a flag, you know. Trishira Kanchanas Ketu Talastasya Mahatmana. Tal meaning like a pole, like a structure, like a, you know, palm tree, something is there, big structure. Mahatmana. Trishira Kanchanas Ketu Stalastasya Mahatmana Sthapita Parvatasyagre. It has been established at the front of a mountain. Virajati Sa Vedika, with the Veda Bhumi, like a Yajna Bhumi, like a rectangle is there at the bottom of it. Now, why is this big deal, just like that Arundhati Vasishta? Because today you can go to Peru, and on the west coast, of course, the coast is only on the west side, you can near the Bay of Paracas, you can see a trident-like structure. It's known as a candelabra of Andes. And you can have that picture in front of you. I've given many talks on it. And you can have this Ramayana verse next to you. And you can see 1:1 correspondence, not even a single detail missing. Now, when Spaniards came there, they asked, like, where they saw the structure, they said, did you do it? I said, no, we didn't do it, the locals there. He said, what about your grandparents? No, it was always there. They said it was always there. So nobody, the locals also don't know, the memory possibly lost. But Ramayana not only describes the structure, Ramayana tells you in the next shloka, who made it, why it was made, when it was made. Purvasya Adishi Nirmanam, just like we have an international day line that goes through the Pacific, to establish the end of a east direction, just like today we say Japan, somewhere we have to start it, right? Somewhere we have to end it. Purvasya Adishi Nirmanam, Krutan Tratri Dasheshvare, Indra. Indra is the deity of the east direction. Indra established it there. And when was it done? It was done in a Kruta Yuga, that is to say, long time before Ramayana. Well, the reference is in Ramayana, so it has to be before Ramayana. So that description comes, no mention of Patal, but if you go to Puranas, you say which Puranas? Almost all Puranas, but Bhagavat Purana is a good one, Vishnu Purana is a good one. Ramayana is a good one, where Ravana goes there. Like Shurpanakha is actually been married, Ravana's sister, and has gone to South America. Kalakeya, or I forgot her husband's name.
Actually, so hold on. Let's pull it up on the screen. This is a lot of data.
Yes,
and I would actually like to see it. What was the name of the mountain?
It's called Candela Bra, C-A-N-D-L-E, Bra, like candle stand. Candela Bra of Andes. This one.
Oh, this is a real thing.
Yes.
It exists in the stone.
Yeah. And now if I sing that again, okay, it's like almost 800 feet tall.
Damn. Okay.
Trishira, Kanchana, Golden, Ketu, Talastasya Mahatmana, Sthapita Parvata Sagre, at the top of the mountain stone. And just look at the bottom. Virajati Sa Vedikaha. You see the rectangle at the bottom?
Yeah.
Like a Yajna Bhumi, you know, we call that Vedika. You know, Virajati Sa Vedika.
So the locals don't know how far back this dates.
Correct.
It's lost knowledge.
They don't know who created. They don't know why it was created.
But it's described in the Puranas.
Ramayana.
Damn.
And it's not like Ramayana is described somewhere and we are somehow making the dots. No. Starting with India, going in the east direction, after going through Thailand, Myanmar and Indonesia, then the crossing the ocean, and now you come at the land and this is where it is.
I wonder what the designs symbolize, because it seems like it contains some meaning. The Trishul, it's obvious.
Yes.
And again, Trishuls are not just related to Shiva or Mata.
Correct, it's an ancient part of culture. It's even the weapon, right? Think of it.
What do Trishuls signify? Because it's there in Greek culture as well, Poseidon's.
Everywhere.
What meaning does it have in our culture?
I mean, it's a weapon, right? It's a very effective weapon. Like those people who have worked with the snakes, they might know that, you know, the Kamberu. You know the word Kamberu? It goes like this. I mean, I have killed many snakes.
You've killed snakes?
I have to, right? They come inside the house, right? During the rainy season. But there is a certain way it allows to hold. So this one is like a three prong, right? So at least one of them will do the job,
right?
When you throw at someone.
Have you ever wondered about what those designs mean?
No, I haven't gone that far.
But do you think it could mean something?
See, what the description is, it is the insignia of Ananta. But I'm going to give you one more surprise there. Okay, so the shlok comes there. We can pull the shlok also if you want. Okay, so go to valmikiramayana.net.
That's a website? Valmiki Ramayana.
Whole Valmiki Ramayana is there.
Okay, let me just read out the English translation. Yeah. On that Shalmali Island in Wine Ocean, you will be seeing the mansion of Vinata's son named Garuda, the eagle vehicle of Vishnu, which is decorated with numerous jewels and which in sheen will be like Mount Kailash, the abode of Shiva. This mansion is construction of Vishwakarma, the heavenly architect.
So the mansion was there. Archaeologists have not found it, or it might have been destroyed, you know. But go to the next one. Now this Rakshasa begins, okay? Tasya Shaila Nibha Bhima Mandeha Nama Rakshasa Shaila Shrungeshu Lambante Nana Rupa Bhayavaha. There are three types of vampire bats that are found in the fossils.
Just let me give one more piece of context here.
Yeah.
We had Ami Ganatra on the show, who I felt was one of the premier experts on both Ramayana and Mahabharata. And she constantly keeps highlighting Valmiki's Ramayana as the only Ramayana that should be referenced when it comes to even storytelling. And this is all based on Valmiki's
Ramayana.
Okay, so this is as much proof as you can have as a Sanatani.
Yes.
Now let's go on.
Okay. So, now you can read the translation for verse 41.
Thereabout, horrifying and merciless demons of various shapes and similar to mountains in size, called Mandehas, will be dangling upside down from mountain peaks.
Who is dangling upside down?
Bats.
Right? Now, so sometime, you know, I wouldn't say exaggeration, but embellishments, like mountain in size, you know, maybe it's like a mountain. In fact, their color is like an ash color, like a mountain stone color, you know. So not always mountain size. They're not that big. But embellishment can happen. Now people may remember because of this.
Or perhaps, I mean, when we talk about megafauna, they say that all the animals that we see around us are only 1% of the animals that have ever existed.
Which is very true.
And they constantly talk about megafauna being prevalent in unexplored lands. Like Australia has a lot of megafauna even today. The big birds.
Correct.
The kangaroos are megafauna in so many ways. But if you study zoology, megafauna was extremely prevalent in Australia. And I'm sure it was prevalent in South America because of Galapagos Islands also.
Exactly. I would agree. And also, the biggest extinction of them happened in 11,000 BC.
After Younger Dryas.
Yeah, around that time. Exactly. During the Younger Dryas. beginning of a younger dryas.
Damn.
Possible. Yeah, yeah. And Graham Hancock talks about it. But I have Quaternary Extinction, a book this thick, and it just goes on and on. We can talk about the four tusk elephants, but we'll come to that, that are also described in Ramayana.
Okay, the first half of this episode, I was just in a very active brain zone. Right now, my skin is active. I'm just getting goosebumps with like every sentence.
Yeah, but let's complete this first, okay? Then we'll come to four tusk elephants. Okay, so you understand that although it is called Rakshasa, in reality, it is a bat, okay? Now, go down, yeah. Te patanti jale nityam suryasya udayanam prati. When the morning happens, they go up there, look at the shadow and catch their prey. You know, you can read if you want. The day after day.
Day after day, those demons will be falling in water when sun always burns them at sunrise. Mm-hmm. And when the impetus of Gayatri hymn fells them down, yet they will be resurfacing and dangling on the mountain day after day. Seems a lot like some kind of giant bats.
Right?
Okay. Yes.
Now today, with the remaining, whatever we have remaining, the megafauna 99% being extinct, but even with what we have, right now we have three varieties of these bats, vampire bats, in South America. Now, we have watched too many vampire movies. So we think vampire bats are everywhere around the world. No, most of them, I mean, they eat animals and insects and all, and then fruits and whatnot. But the vampire bats, in the sense of blood-sucking bats, in the whole world, they are only available right now in South America. Okay, so this is very solid evidence for that, by the way. Okay, now go down. Okay, keep on going down. We skip slowly. Yeah, okay. Just let me read that. Okay, so Shweto Rushabho Nama Parvata. White Rushabha Parvata. This is referring to Andes, by the way.
You're talking about this 44B?
44 first line, yeah. 44 first line, you know. In the center of that milk ocean, there is a white mountain of colossal size.
Named Rishabh. Surrounded with closely growing trees, ever flowered with flowers of heavenly fragrance.
Yeah.
And a lake, renowned as Lake Sudarshan, is also there.
Go to Amazon, go to Bolivia, Peru. Beautiful.
Which is replete with silvery lotuses whose fibrils are golden in sparkle and which kingly swans will be scampering about.
Yeah. Well, now go to the next one. Like, so skip 46. It's not that relevant. Okay. Keep on going down. I'll tell you. Yeah.
Damn, how deep have you gone in this stuff, sir?
Well, you full stop. But I wanted to show. Okay, here. 51. Okay. Can you bring up? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So stick there. Ah. 52, and you know, you can read the whole translation, but I'll read 52.
Sure.
Now, we are talking of Andes Mountain. We are going to talk of the structure in the verse 53 that I just read, and we saw the candelabra of Andes. But just before that, it is saying this structure that we saw is the insignia for the Ananta, which is verse 52. Asinam parvatasya agre sarva bhuta namaskritam sahasra shirasam devam anantam neel vasasam. Anantam. And sahasra shirsha is what? All the peaks of Andes. That's what the analogy is. Okay?
There you shall see then, O Vanar, the lotus petal, broad-eyed, thousand-hooded serpent god in black clothing. The lotus petal, broad-eyed, thousand-hooded serpent god in black clothing named Ananta sitting on top of that mountain. That's what the symbol was. And sustaining the earth on his head, who will be like moon in his brilliance and whom all beings hold in reverence.
They all will have a meaning. We'll ignore it for the, you know, for brevity.
I think it's describing the symbol.
For brevity. But something else I want to tell you. So the next one is the insignia is given, which we already discussed. But now what I want you to do is go to search function. So remember Ananta. Okay. Ananta is referred to the Andes mountain with its sahasra heads as the each peak.
Right.
Now go to search and type Mount Ananta in Andes. Okay. So it will come like a cerro.
Oh,
okay. So yeah.
Yes.
Now story is very similar to this candelabra of Andes. Now what can happen? The Western world came in contact with South America in the recent times only 500 years ago. So two possibilities, either somebody from Spain or Western Europe who has studied Ramayana very well or Indian literature has been fascinated with the name Ananta, went to South America, and one of the peak he gave the name Ananta. That's one possibility. What is the other possibility? We have a description next to the trident in Valmiki Ramayana. That name was there from the beginning. And I have gone through the searching for it. By the way, let me give the credit where it is due. One of the person, Mitra Desai, that I mentioned, who is in Australia, and she has written a novelette called Flag of Ananta, based on this research. And she discovered this Mount Ananta. Not my discovery. But it is there in Valmiki Ramayana.
Descriptions about South America.
Name. You know, we don't have to do a guesswork. And if you look at it, like, you know, if you say, okay, who gave the name? Like, which Spaniard gave the name? You come across saying, this is a native Indian language. Indian meaning those Indians there. Quechua or Ayamara. Those are the languages. It comes from there. Bottom line, nobody knows. Well, Ramayana knows.
Dear archaeologists. I mean, see, this is where a lot of people get stumped. I'm talking about academia,
right?
In specific.
Yes.
Where they don't have responses to this.
They will call it coincidence.
Mm.
But how many coincidences do you need? For example, Aurora Borealis will not do that. That will be another separate episode. Sugriva's Atlas, if we do it. Sugriva, in summary, knew when he is asking Vanara parties to go in four different directions and he's giving them landmarks like this. This is only in the east direction. He gives the landmarks in the north direction. Kailash and everything going further. The plantation of the bamboos and everything. And you can...
Can we talk a little bit about this?
Sure.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
What has he spoken about in the north?
In the north, he says, start with the center of India. Always, you know, start from like a gateway of India type of thing, you know, center of India. You go further. Now he's going across the sort of a Tibet slash Tibet, you know, where how we people do Kailash Yatra these days. He says, you will come to the Kailash area. He describes Kailash area, not a surprise. People may easily know that, but he describes it. He says, a beautiful land, cooler temperatures, no trees. And you can go and check it even now, kind of thing. After that, he says, the land of many rivers, which is, if you consider which land is that, that is the 40 latitude today, like the western part of China, today's China, and then Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, that area. That is called Uttara Kuru and Uttara Madra in our literature. So we say where it is, it's there in Mahabharata, it's there in Ramayana, and it is there in the Puranas. Okay. After that, now this is, remember, this is the description from 14,000 years ago. Today you can go just fine until the Arctic Sea, at least in the summer. But Sugriv, 14,000 years ago, he is saying, and I'm putting the 40 latitude just to make a point. He says, beyond Uttara Kuru and Uttara Madra, there is a land. Sugriv beautifully describes what it is, but he tells the Vanara party, do not dare go there. If you go there, you will, first thing, it's very hard to go. He describes Arctic Sea all the way. Uttara Samudra, Uttaram Payasam Nidhi. That's how he describes the Arctic Sea. But if you go there, you will find it impossible to commit back. Now, why is that? Because the ice age is taking place there. People think ice age meaning the whole earth was covered. That was not the case in last million years. But the whole entire Europe, especially Northern Europe and Northern America, they were covered with ice. So he's saying, don't go there. There's like a permafrost and tundra-like conditions. We know that from the climatology study. So he says, don't go there. So that's in the north direction. He describes Aurora Borealis. You know what that is? Northern lights.
Yeah.
So he says, even when it's a dark land, when the sun is not there, but the place is so bright, it's beautiful.
Mm.
Okay, Aurora Borealis possible is referring to. Mahabharata also describes when Arjuna goes there. Now, if you go to the south, he in the southern direction, of course, the Lanka, you know. But further, he's describing the land all the way to Antarctica. Now, in the modern description, Antarctica was found only in the 18th century. If you see the maps before 18th century, the Western maps, the Antarctica is like left empty. Now, there are some maps in Italy, for example, and Turkey, who actually show the landmass there. Those are from 15th century. What does that tell you? And this is guy Piri Reis. I don't know if that came into any of these things. Piri Reis was a Turkish navy man, like admiral or something. And he says he created this world map based on, this is 15th century, 16th century. So Columbus maps also he used. But then he says he used the maps of the Arab land. He used the ancient maps of Hind. And he created. And if you see that, he is showing Antarctica like a land with exact mapping that you can match with Antarctica. The map was created in 15th century. But history books and academia will teach you that Antarctica was discovered by Europeans in 18th century, 17 something.
Because the winners of war always rewrite history books.
Yeah, because discovery has a very different meaning in the West. Discovery meaning under the dictates, under the permission of the Christian church, the Pope, you find certain land. It doesn't matter whose it belongs to. You basically grab it. Church has given you the right to grab it for yourself. Whoever discovers it, meaning literally sees it. So Vasco da Gama discovered us. It doesn't matter what rights we have, what we want. To him, it was like the India is for him to explore and exploit. And that's what he did, to the best of his ability. And then the British did the same thing. So the inside their psyche it is there. For that, we can blame them. You know, not the blame the current,
residents. Issue is also that modern academia still completely blindly looks at that system as gospel. In so many ways.
Yes, because see, academia is the same. I gave a definition of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, you know. See, it is a regimented thing that they want to stay there. It's a regimented thing.
Which is why countries have straight borders now. So that conflict remains in these countries. We remain third world.
Mm-hmm.
Why has Kashmir been divided in this way?
Correct.
So that we would be at war for hundreds of years and both countries would suffer.
Exactly.
And be engaged with each other.
Yeah. Same thing they did in Africa.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a century long geopolitical ploy that's actually still working.
Right.
Teaches us a lot about how human society can work also.
True.
Anyway, that we're drifting away.
Now, since I have gone three directions, let me take a minute and do the west direction.
Yeah, sure.
So going from India again, central India, Saurashtra, and going through modern day Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Romania, Sugriva is describing all these lands with a chain of mountains, range of mountains. That's what it is. If you look at the geographical map of the world, that's what you will find. He describes all the way up to the Alps. And he says beyond, he calls it Astagiri. By the way, Andes, he calls it Udayachala Mountain, you know. And then to Alps, he's calling it Astagiri. So Sugriva, in effect, just to summarize, knew 14,000 years ago, from Andes to Alps and from Arctic Sea to Antarctica.
What is Asta? Giri is mountain.
Asta is a set, sun setting. Set. Setting
sunset
of a
mountains.
Sun. Yeah. Udaya, Asta.
Okay.
Yeah. Rising.
Where? And the mountains set. Where the sun sets.
Sunsets. From the point of view of India, if you think of it, with the India in between.
Sure.
Yeah.
In the same way that he's described bats in South America, has he described other megafauna or people in other lands?
People, especially in the Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, that area. Oh, beautiful descriptions. I mean, we can go for hours. Beautiful description. Like, you know, he describes the folks whose ears, and now you can see that in Africa today, ears have come down to like, you know, to their waist or something, or the lips coming down, which you see in Africa.
Body modification.
Yeah, body modifications. Yeah, like this. And in Indonesia proper, also in the Papua New Guinea, you actually see people putting all kinds of paraphernalia, just like a feathers and decorating themselves and so on. And those descriptions come there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else about megafauna?
Megafauna, not much. At least not that I recall right now.
Okay. Yeah. The question that's popping up in my head is the whole Hanumanji jumping across the ocean and then meeting an asur on the way to Lanka.
Yeah.
And then slaying that asur.
Yeah. On the way to Lanka, right?
Yeah.
My co-researcher, again, amazing researcher, Rupa Bhati. Bhatiji, she's out of Gujarat. She's an architect by profession, but this is what we do, engineer and then do something. She has, her interpretation of it is that As Hanuman was going to Lanka, and not to Sri Lanka, by the way, that will be open another box, so I won't do that right
now.
We
will be doing that.
but it's referring to actually going, think of this as going east of Maldives. That's where Ravana's Lanka was. Right now, there is nothing, just a deep ocean.
West of Maldives?
East of Maldives. Because
okay.
Zero prime meridian.
Understood.
That goes through Kurukshetra, Sthaneshwar, Ujjain, Vatapi, and Lanka. Lanka is 00. Zero longitude, zero latitude, sure, kind of thing. You know, right on the equator. So that's where we have to go, Maldives. We have to just go east of Maldives. Right now there is a deep ocean with a geological anomaly. Again, we won't open that box right now. It won't tell us much. Other than something funny happened there.
What do you mean something funny happened?
The earth crust there below the ocean is one of the thinnest. And we don't know why that happened, but it's just one of the geological anomaly, you know. So that's something to be noted down for maybe for future research.
Why do geologists believe that it's thin?
They don't know. That's why it's an anomaly and sort of a mystery and, you know, research.
What if you dig through?
It will be interesting thing to do.
Need a geologist on the show to
ask
about that.
That's right.
So effectively, what you're saying is, either there was an island there that got submerged.
Yeah. Or it even possibly, again, Rupa Bhattiji has done great research, many similar things. Or because of, say, and I'm going to come to that question that you ask about Hanuman meeting, running into these individual creatures. Very volcanically, possibly very active area then. And there are evidence that going back to only 2 centuries, 3 centuries, it has happened in Indonesia. A small island with an active volcano broke into pieces. So actually when it broke, it split, it moved on the surface of the ocean, so to say. Literally the, you know, islands became separated from each other. Something might have happened and then it would have disappeared, and Maldives and the whole Lakshadweep could be pieces of that, you know. I mean, that's all speculation for now.
If it exploded, it would have gone in the east direction also and perhaps joined that whole Papua New Guinea.
That's too far. Too far, right? Where we are looking at, you know, from Papua New Guinea or Indonesia would be too far. But this, so this is a possibility.
Do you think that the modern island of Sri Lanka was not a part of the ancient Ramayana?
No, it would be part of ancient Ramayana. It wasn't Ravana's Lanka. And there is a sufficient evidence for that. For example, Sri Lanka, I don't know if you know this, but the name Sri Lanka was given in 1972. Now, what happens is, for example, the land of Sri Lanka could be part of Ravana's kingdom for all it matters. We don't know that. India, majority of India was part of Ravana's kingdom. You know, like a whole Maharashtra was a part of Ravana's kingdom based on this description. But what we know is that even recent histories, like going back to only 1,000 years, when people are writing, and our Puranas, many times they will say, like person living from there, Lanka, then going to this island, then going to this island. In the list, they will refer to Simvaladweep, which is the old name of Sri Lanka.
Simvaladweep.
Because Simvalis moved there. I mean, the
Sinhalese,
right, correct, right? So that is a very recent, I'm talking last 1,000 years. But my point is, even in the last 1,000 years, they are referring to Lanka as a separate place from Simvaladweep. Mm.
So effectively here,
yeah,
you are disagreeing with extreme right-wing portals which highlight the Ram Setu as one of the most important parts of Ramayana history. You're not refuting the Ramayana 100%.
Correct.
But you're trying to look at it from a more evidence-based geographical perspective that the island of Sri Lanka is not Ravan's Lanka that we hear about in Ramayana.
Right.
But Ravan's Lanka was possibly an island that was accompanied with a lot of volcanic activity that perhaps got submerged, just like that Atlantis story that we've heard about.
Yes.
And I remember reading this report way back. This is when I was a teenager and websites used to be very popular in the mid-2000s. Someone had written an article about how Atlantis possibly could be Lanka.
It doesn't need to be. Actually, again, if you have to go there, we have to pull another graph. And
go for
it. Okay.
Go for it.
Okay, go to Google. Paul Blanchon. Okay, so yeah, the same guy. By the way, he did his PhD in the same university where I was doing my master's in Canada, you know. Amazing individual. Now, what we need is one of his paper. Okay, reef drowning during the last glaciation. Hold on, just give me a second. What year is that?
1995.
Perfect. Click on that.
Yeah, we.
And you're going to be fascinated. I'm going to show you three Atlantis.
Damn.
One is Ravana's Lanka. Second one is the Plato's Atlantis. Third one is Krishna's Dwarka. Right on one chart, if we find this. Okay?
Reef drowning during the last deglaciation.
Yes.
Evidence for catastrophic sea level rise and ice sheet collapse. This is the global warming that happened in that phase. And by the way, the global warming we see today is accelerated because of pollution.
Correct.
But it is also an act of nature, taking away nothing from the reality of global warming. It's a massive problem, environmentally speaking, today.
Correct.
But the Earth goes through cycles of cooling and warming up, which is why we see ice ages in the first place.
Yeah.
And deglaciation,
correct,
which is what he's talking about. The question I have for you is, was this nature-based or was it because of some catastrophic event like a meteor strike?
No, it doesn't. It's not a meteor strike. It is that global warming that has begun in the last 20,000 years. Again, it's not some global warming the first time. No, the whole cycles based on astronomy as well, that's going on.
Right.
So last 20,000 years ago, why do we say that? Because that was the LGM, last glacial maximum. And since then, water sea levels are rising. Okay. So the sea levels are rising very smoothly, but they are interrupted by these CRE, catastrophic rise event. So otherwise it's going like this. But it's like this. Okay. So these are the three.
As in temperatures warm up gradually according to the natural course of things.
Correct.
But sometimes events happen because of which suddenly the temperature will increase.
Simple example would be, say there's a block of ice sitting and it's slowly melting. But a point comes when it cracks and a big block falls down.
Okay, gotcha.
Something like that. So suddenly that's going to create waves into the water.
And then just that block of ice breaking down will create a lot of weather changes. It'll recreate maps,
changes the water levels, migrations of people, loss of life. And
everything that people are afraid that global warming will cause in the 2030s and 40s could happen in one shot if nature wills it, like it happened back then.
Catastrophic.
Hence the name. Geologically speaking, can this happen randomly even now?
Yes.
That's what people fear.
Yes.
Environmentally conscious people fear this exactly.
Correct. And see, environmentally, we should be cautious irrespective of this global warming and cooling sea levels rising because we need a clean earth.
Yeah.
And earth is dying, in many ways. But in terms of the sea level rise, we may be close to how high it gets.
Okay.
That is not to say be very comfortable in Mumbai and Los Angeles and New York. No, we should worry.
Like it's going to get worse.
It might get worse before it gets better.
Mm.
But we are almost, if you look at the 100,000 years of record, we are almost there in terms of the highest sea level.
Right.
Possibly.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not letting you continue. Again, this is for better understanding. We had a meteorologist
yesterday.
He's one of the most reputed ones in the world. His name is Dr. Jagdish Shukla and he's contributed a lot to the Indian climate change movement, etc.
Yeah.
And he's contributed a lot to even the Indian science scene. Anyway, not getting into that.
Yeah.
He spoke about how the way we're going right now, if we don't stop polluting the earth and using fossil fuels, then by 2030, we're going to do irreversible damage to the earth. So we only have 6 years left until we actually see perhaps a bit of an apocalyptic situation. Only 6 years.
That wouldn't surprise me. I would say similar predictions has come in the past, and that's not to discount what he's saying. Actually, I'm so glad he's saying this. But the human nature is such that humans will not understand. Many of them have no luxury to understand with their daily survival things. So it is for people who have a luxury of thinking like this to do something about it. But what will happen is the earth is also extremely vibrant, and it is capable of reversing itself.
Mm.
But that's not to discount his point. Actually, I don't know if it's a 6 years, because similar predictions I have even heard in 1990s and we are still around, but maybe not as healthy as we ought to be or things like that. Yeah. So it is happening. I mean, the oceans are dying in a certain way. You know, the sea life is going away with the organic fertilizers. The land is getting very, very bad. So like Sadhguruji's movement for soil save soil. These are all very good initiatives.
Okay. Now let's carry
on. We are talking Ravana's Lanka right now.
Sure.
But where is the dirt archaeology evidence? This is dirt archaeology evidence. You see, for example, that vertical line, this is basically, so x-axis is the time, y-axis is the rise in the sea level.
Gotcha.
Okay. Now, you see the vertical line where you see it. Okay. The most vertical line that you see there.
The vertical rise.
Vertical rise, correct? Yeah. If you draw a straight vertical line above there, it is going to hit at 5,525. I mean, maybe you can find 5,525 and just draw a line. Mahabharata text says that Krishna's Dwarka was flooded and destroyed by gushing sea waters 36 years after the Mahabharata war. 5561 plus 36, we have to do minus 36 because of BC, 5525 BC. In the middle of 6th millennium BCE, which is 5525 BCE, 5500 BCE, there was a, this is Arabian Sea data. Dwarka is on the Arabian Sea, west coast of India. Sudden sea level rise, listen to this, of 15 meters. Imagine 15 meters happen in Mumbai. Forget 15 meters. 3 meters would be disastrous. 15 meters sudden sea level rise in the middle of 6th millennium BCE in the Arabian Sea. That's Krishna's Dwarka getting destroyed.
Mm-hmm. 2 meters is about a 6 foot 6 guy.
6 feet, yeah.
And you're saying 15 meters.
So 50 feet.
7 times that much. 7 6.5 foot guys kept one above the other. Yes. That's how much sea levels rose.
Yes.
All over the world?
Mm. That's the interesting part. We can go around the world if you like. But this one is only the Arabian Sea, which is has a direct connection with the Krishna's Dwarka.
I wonder why, keeping physics in mind, it wasn't all over the world.
Ah, great point. Actually, a brilliant question. And I'm not doing this to praise you.
I'll still take it.
The brilliant question. Do you know why? Because there is a phenomenon called subsidence or subsidence. Whereas because water is a liquid, you would imagine that around the world, they are all connected. And in an equilibrium state, they should attain the same height.
Yeah.
True. But the local landmass with respect to the ocean level is also changes.
Okay. God, because land can be shaped differently.
Locally, right? Because these are the tectonic plates, tectonic plates.
Right. So and some pieces of land might block out the water like a dam.
Correct. And actually land goes down. That has happened in Dholavira in Gujarat. The land has come up in our times. So the ocean is no longer there in Dholavira. Two reasons. Actually, water level is coming up. So why the water went away from Dholavira? Because the land has risen. There. But so this is Dwarka, Krishna's Dwarka.
What Sir is effectively saying is the crust of the earth is not like an eggshell. It's like a combination of different pieces of earth that go all around, float around, but also go up and down.
Correct. And then there are many other sub-phenomena. Like we call it, this is a tectonic, like the tectonic land, but there is something called earth crust displacement. Also earth crust displacement, like a orange skin moving over the core of the orange without moving the core of the orange. Wow. That's another phenomenon. Something else. Depending on the quality of the clay and everything, what sinks, what comes up in an individual area changes. You know, it's a very complex phenomenon.
Okay.
Now, remember the time of Ramayana. There is no written evidence, but in the tradition of India, Kerala, I have seen from a Kerala novelist. Actually, he used my dating and wrote a novel. I mean, he wrote his novel, used my dating of 12,209. Okay. Trivin Nair. Okay. So 12,000. Now remember that KA is like 1,000 years before today. Before today. So to get to
14.2 KA is 14,200 years.
Is it 12.2? Gotcha. Like 12.2 BCE, 12,209, exactly that time. Now, remember, because it's a scientific thing, it always has a standard error of plus minus 150 years and so on. So around that area, you see what is happening. So x-axis is time, y-axis is the sea level rise. So we have to start from here, from the right, 20,000 years ago. And we are coming towards the left as our today's time.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So slowly water level is rising, but at 14.2, which is Ramayana times, suddenly there is a sea level rise of 13.5 meters and then plus minus whatever it is.
Which is probably what sank original...
Lanka. Ravana's Lanka. Now, this is a speculation in the sense there is no explicit reference to the destruction of Ravana's Lanka. But if you come to Mahabharata, there is no clear description of Ravana's Lanka. Whereas in Ramayana times, Rama is going there. Mm. In Mahabharata times, Sahadev calls Bhima's son, Ghatotkaj, and says, please go on my behalf to Vibhishan and just get his permission when they are doing the Rajasya Yajna.
Mm.
So this is called, there is another field, I mean, our academics should know that, called hagiography, or sort of think of it as a fill in the blanks. When all the information is not there, still somebody is going to ask, what happened to Ravana's Lanka during the Mahabharata times? So the narrator has filled it with this. But here, quickly,
yeah.
So that is that possibly the loss of Ravana's Lanka, that 14.2 event. CRE1.
Right.
Now, do you remember when Atlantis was gone? If you listen to Plato, in his time, he said that happened 9,000 years ago. Now, Plato's time is 2,000 years ago, which means 9,000 BC is what we need to go to. 9,000 years ago before Plato is 11,000 years ago from today.
Hmm.
Look at the CRE2. 11.5 event.
Damn.
Huh? That's Atlantis.
This is somewhere between the time period of Ramayana and Mahabharata.
Between Ramayana and Mahabharata.
Has anything like this been spoken
that's,
about?
That's in... the, think of that. That's the end of Younger Dryas.
Right. That's the massive meteor strike that happened. Not all of these jumps are meteor strikes, but
yeah.
That one is.
Yeah. And I can explain, I mean, I would not do that today. I can explain based on Paul Blanchard's research and some of the other research that I have done on this, what caused this. But it's a very complex phenomenon. It's like a geology going deep down 200 levels.
Okay.
Okay. So, we'll so not,
it's not as simple as a meteor strike?
No. Meteor strike for CRE2 possibly. But what caused CRE1 and what caused CRE3? See, for us, on the map, it looks the same, but the causes are very different. Just as an example, the causes for CRE1, CRE2 are driven from the northern point, northern hemisphere, like ice melting in North America and Western Europe. The last one is caused by Antarctica.
CRE3?
Yes.
Which is the Dwarka 1.
Dwarka 1. Okay. So, I mean, that has to do with understanding dynamics at a different level. That's not a subject today, not why. But now the CRE3, look at the timing. 7.6 Ka, subtract 2000, that's 5.6, 5600 BCE, plus minus 130 years. That's the standard error there. So, anywhere in that time, and 5600 BCE plus minus 130 years, 5525 falls right there. And so you asked me the question, is the sea level rise the same everywhere? The answer is no. This is in Barbados. This is in West Indies, Caribbean. So there the dynamics of the land and the sea is different than what is...
What is in Barbados?
This data is from Barbados.
Oh, gotcha.
From West Indies.
Got it. As in... So there,
like in Arabian Sea, I showed you 15 meter rise. There it is only 6.5 meter rise, exactly same time.
Got it. So there is an effect all over the globe. It's just different in different parts.
Very good. I have done research, shown 30 different places around the globe for 5525 BCE. Decisive, no ifs, no buts evidence for flooding and destruction of Krishna's Dwarka.
This is real... archaeology and the real work of a real historian.
An adult archaeology. That's why I said I have nothing against archaeologists. In fact, I am archaeologist. How can I be against myself?
Yeah.
Again, the three steps. The first step is great. Second step, dating is great. The third step, when they connect the dots, they don't even go that far because in their subjective mind, they meaning not just archaeologists, people in general, those who don't believe in deep antiquity for human civilization, they say, how is something possible from a human perspective happening 7,000 years ago? We were monkeys. Well, that is their problem. Their premise is wrong. Therefore, they don't even think of going that far.
Mm.
In fact, the beauty of Ramayana and Mahabharata is once we astronomically figured this out, therefore, I'm looking for what caused the destruction of Ravana's Lanka and Atlantis and Krishna's Dwarka. Otherwise, why would you even go and look at this graph? That will be a waste of time to somebody who does not believe any great human civilization was happening more than 5,000 years ago. The person will not even look here.
We had a member of the MACOs, which is the commando unit of the Indian Navy on the show, whose job was to actually dive and explore Dwarka. And he didn't reveal a lot on the podcast. We actually didn't end up releasing the podcast because he revealed very less on the show. And I felt like it wasn't good enough for an episode by itself.
Yeah.
But he was convinced that he was actually exploring the Dwarka of that age.
Yeah.
And he's a scuba diver. So I asked him, did you go inside the structure? He said it's extremely dangerous to go inside that city structure because it under the ocean, it degrades and almost becomes sand.
Yes.
So you can get buried in that sand
debris.
Yeah. But when you touch it, it can actually disintegrate and all. So he's like, we're categorically told not to explore it too much.
Right.
But I think that's as far as the Dwarka explorations have gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I know that Graham Hancock himself also keeps coming to India to explore Dwarka and Tamil Nadu.
Yes. And by the way, do you know that what Graham Hancock and the geologist Glenn Milne, he's a Canadian just like me. I'm a Canadian and American and Indian, by the way. Yes. So I have communicated with Glenn Milne a lot on this geology data. So Graham Hancock and Glenn Milne, when they researched Dwarka and the time period they came up with, do you know what that time period is? 5525 BC. They show, I mean, if you see the Graham Hancock film on this underworld or whatever it is, the disappearance of an island on the west coast of Gujarat, that is Dwarka, and I agree with him completely. You know, it's there in my research too. It disappeared between 7,900 and 6,900 BP, which is to basically say our date falls, 5525 falls right between. So then he moved on. It is too sad because if you would have stuck to it, now see, this is the challenge, okay? So for example, I don't know. I mean, Graham Hancock does so much more research. He's always exploring more fields, so he may not have a time. But it surprises me that he has done the research. And only if it takes the pain of just opening my book, which many people have suggested to him, I don't know why he has not opened. That's like a bingo, another reward for him for all the hard work that he has done. For some reason, he has not connected the dots. I don't know why. But whatever he claimed for Dwarka is what I have shown. But from what? From the all the archaeology data, but also from the narrative data, also from the astronomy data. So literary, the narrations, the terrestrial and the celestial. So this is a terrestrial evidence.
Mm.
This is a terrestrial. And it's happening in 30 different places. You go to Vietnam, you find it. Black Sea in Turkey. The formation of Black Sea. Again, maybe we'll do another one on this separate Dwarka. Krishna's Dwarka is an episode by itself. The formation of Black Sea. Do you know when it was formed? You can take a good guess now. 5525 BCE. Now, this is a very fascinating story that possibly your audience would love to hear. So I have written my book, first book, When Did the Mahabharata War Happen? The Mystery of Arundhati in 2011. And I'm full-time working for a big corporation that time. So I'm not talking much about it other than doing my research. Fast forward to 2015 or so, I have written my second book also, The Historic Ram. A prisoner from Tennessee prison writes an email to me and he's been caught for some pot or something which was not allowed at that time there. So he writes and he's writing something and I'm not exactly understanding what he's referring to. But he says, everyone is talking about the 6th millennium BCE and now is this new guy, he's referring to me. Oh, he's also talking about something happening. And I asked him because I was fascinated. I responded to him, says, who else is talking about this? So he sends me the name of the book. And immediately I went and pulled that book from the library. The book is written by two geologists from Columbia University, New York. Okay, Ryan and Pittman. And they have given some name like a Noah's Ark or Finding Noah's Flood or something. What they have shown is the creation of the Black Sea, which is, if you think of geographically, I don't know if you want to bring like a geography of the Europe kind of thing. Perfect. Excellent. Excellent. Beautiful. So you have the Black Sea there, right? So you see the word Spain yeah. and Portugal. Just yeah. below that is that Gibraltar area. That is the entrance to Mediterranean from Atlantic.
Hmm.
So now imagine this is a global event. This 55-25 BC Krishna's Dwarka is a global event everywhere. Like I show you the Mediterranean and, and Caribbean and all that. So the sea level rising into Atlantic, the water is gushing into Mediterranean. From Mediterranean, think where the Greece is. That is the Aegean Sea. You come further to the Greece near that Bulgaria or whatever return. That is the Sea of Marmara. And now if you want to expand just to the Black Sea, so where the Istanbul is written, that is the Sea of Marmara on the south and the Black Sea is on the north. There is that Bosphorus Channel, basically. Yeah. So the all the force of the salt water broke through that Bosphorus Channel and the salty water started pouring to the north into now what is Black Sea. But it was essentially a sweet water lake coming from the there. And, you know, using 9 different scientific parameters, Ryan and Pittman from Columbia University have shown that this event was a sudden event and it happened 55-25 BC. And the book is out there. So this prisoner from the Tennessee prison sent me the information about this. And I'm saying, my God, I'm researching this for like a 15 plus 20 years now and I did not know anything about this. Again, the point I want to drive is, unless I'm looking for evidence for 55-25 BC, even if somebody presents it to me, I will not see it. Right? So you should have a possibilities. So if people in their subjective foolish judgment close their eyes and say nothing happened before 5000 BC, even if there is evidence, they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. Because a lot of their life's work and lectures and public talks will be proved slightly wrong, if not entirely wrong.
Yeah. And the thing with that is, in science, actually, see, all the revolutions happen by proving the previous theory wrong. And actually, we should rejoice it.
Yeah.
See, if somebody comes tomorrow and comes up with a year which is different than 55-61 BC, and can scientifically and logically prove that that is a better date than mine, I should be happy and not just somehow fight with that person. Now, what is very clear is that date, I can tell you, would not be any time after 4500 BC because Arundhati Vasishta observation will not work. There is a Bhishma Nirvan. I wrote a whole book on that, which were only 1.5 pages in my first book. And I thought people will get goosebumps. Nobody got a goosebump in 2011, not by 2015. I said, I need to write another book. And now people get goosebumps when they read Bhishma Nirvana. Because it's another piece of evidence from the Mahabharata text. Do you know what it says? Actually, Arundhati Vasishta gives you a time bracket like 10,000 BC to 4,500 BC.
As in the position of the stars, Arundhati and Vasishta.
Only in between that observation is true, what is said in Mahabharata. Bhishma Nirvana evidence gives you like 5125 BC to 6722 BC, a time period of 1,500 years. It says Mahabharata war can only happen here based on the Mahabharata text evidence.
Gotcha. One second, I'll give you one high five for this. When I used to see Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson's work, always think there needs to be some Indian person who needs to go down and do the same kind of work, but from an India context. Honor of my life meeting you today. Just want to say that.
Thank you.
Thank you for a lowdown. This was a lot of fun. That's what I'll say. I hope you enjoyed this real history special. That was only part one of an epic conversation with Nilesh Oak. Rarely has a guest stayed in my mind a week or two after they've appeared on the show. And I'm not exaggerating, but this conversation with Nilesh Oak has been ringing in my head every day since we've recorded with him. My only request to you is that you share this episode as much as you can on WhatsApp. I hope that this reaches the entire history fandom-based community of Bhartiya culture. I hope that this reaches every Indian if possible. The one thing I do know is that this is one of those all-time epic TRS episodes that's going to be relevant even 10 to 15 years from now. It's the age of podcasting in India, but it's fueled because of the research and efforts of people like Nilesh Oak. We'll be back very soon with another stellar episode. We've got an insane lineup coming up this month. So keep supporting TRS. Ranveer and the team, we'll see you very, very soon.